this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening for this next hour is Barry Shamish. Hi, Barry. How are we doing?
I'm all right, and you also sound better today.
Okay, fine. Well, I want you to pick up the story, and you go ahead, and because Barry's going to be going over the material that he's been covering in the past about the background of this group within the Jewish faith who seem to be doing everything they can to destroy Judaism and, in many instances, promoting anti-Semitism and helping the Nazis. And you go right ahead with the story, Barry, because it's the most incredible story. And if I didn't know that this was valid from other sources, I'd say it couldn't be true. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Most of those sources are dead, so you just have to take the survivor's word for it. I'm going to go backwards. It's very upsetting to me personally. And I swore last week that would be it, but what do you know, you phoned me at the last minute, so I'm going to cover the stuff I didn't cover, and let's start with what happened on January 15th, 1936. The German Zionist Federation was given recognition to be the only Jewish group allowed in Nazi Germany. All the rest, well, here's, I'm going to give you the quotes. These are directly from, in this case, the Palestine Post. A bold demand that the German Zionist Federation be given recognition by the Nazi government as the only instrument for the exclusive control of German Jewish life. And then, well, all German Jewish organizations, it was declared, should be dominated by the labor Zionists. Well, that was at the beginning of 36. 37 was the Ship of Fools, great movie, sad, doomed Jews. That was it. In short, all German Jewish organizations, there were over 250, were shut down. And what shut down means, means you were picked up in the middle of the night and sent to some sort of rehabilitation camp, of which you might have got lucky and survived, but then you would have been murdered the next day in a concentration camp. It was the end of Judaism, and any Jew who got on the boat, well, no matter where you went, the order was out. You don't choose Palestine. You just chose back to the Nazis and death. Worldwide, Jewish refugees. And by the way, everyone knew they were doomed. Everyone. It wasn't a secret. If they didn't get to America and South America, there were ships in Venezuela, turned back. In Cuba, turned back. All the ships were turned back because if you didn't choose Palestine, well, too bad for you. You chose death. Let's go on to the next. I'm going to be quoting again directly. Now, I'm going to start. This is the Congress Bulletin. That's the American Jewish Congress. Had a little report on the president of the German Jewish community. Now, his name was George Koreski. We'll get back to him after the music.
You go right ahead. You go right ahead. I'll tell you when to stop. Go ahead.
Well, the president of the Berlin Jewish community, George Koreski, discovered, this is the, quote, compatibility between Hitlerism and Zionism, then voluntarily joined the secret service of the Nazis, of the Reich. He became the Jew who made Hitlerism his Jewish nationalist faith.
And I think it's important to realize that there were Jewish people who were involved in this terrible strengthening of the Nazis and, of course, allowed them to get away with what they did to the Jews. We'll be back in a moment.
Gather all across the sea.
right ahead. Pick the story up.
Now, recall, I have spoken from the beginning before. Now I'm speaking of things I missed. And it's just got awful. George Koreski, he is, well, the president of the Berlin Jewish community. He has declared in Goebbels, well, the Agraf, the Nuremberg Laws, he declared them to be a blessing to the Jews. Now, we're going to return to the name George Koreski. Leading founder of Israel was the president of the German Jewish community. Now, let's go on backwards. All right? Now, this article was from 36. Now we go to 37 when we discover something that, all right, let's just quote. These New Palestine, 1937, Koreski is explaining. This is Koreski. We dealt only with the officials of the ministries and the police, with the Gestapo and the Jewish Department of Goebbels Ministry, or with the Ministry for Economic Affairs. No other Nazis. Well, isn't that nice? Only the Gestapo and Goebbels, like they weren't dealing with Nazis. And then he explains, and he wrote this, that it was morally disturbing to be considered as the favored children of the Nazi government, particularly when it dissolved the anti-Zionist youth groups, and in other ways seemed to prefer the Zionists. Look, this was a year after they were declared the only group of representing every Jew in Germany. There were 550,000 Jews in Germany. They got to run their camps, and they got to send their people. Look, you went into camp, and no matter what you were before, and that often meant a favored profession, medicine, law.
Hold that thought, Barry. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Barry simply talking about this George Koreski. He was sort of the head, the president of the Jews of Berlin. And basically, there were about 550,000 Jewish people in Germany at the time. And this Koreski was actually working with the Nazis. And he was doing everything that he could to neutralize any Jewish resistance to the Nazis. In fact, he said that what happened at Nuremberg, or certainly the Nuremberg Decree, was a wonderful thing. And basically, he was actually working against the best interests of the Jews. And yet the average Jewish person could not believe that at that time, nor can the average Jewish person believe it today, because they've ever been told that within their own ranks were people who were very, very close to the Nazis and helping the Nazis, and you go right ahead.
Yeah, we're going to get to Goebbels. The fact of the matter is that the labor Zionists, and we'll get to it, they were the only Zionists left. They ran the Jewish agency from Jerusalem. They ran the parliament of all the Jews. Oh, they were working with the Nazis. And this is disturbing me. You know what? After all this time, I thought I could live with it. It's actually causing me nightmares. It's awful. Look, I'm just going to give you a quote from the head of the American Jewish Congress. His name was Prinz. What he said, we'll see. Oh, leave it be where the quote is from. This is what he said. He said, "We thought at the beginning of the Hitler regime that a very frank discussion was possible with the Nazis. We found among SS intellectuals some people were ready for such a talk." This is the head of all of the American Jewish Congress, the head of all the biggest Jewish Jewish organization in America was dealing with the Nazis. Look, it does bother me. I got to tell you, the Americans bought into this. Everyone, they forgave this. It was just a strategy. We thought we could get the best deal by pretending we were Nazis. They were running around in Nazi uniforms. Let's go backwards. I said I would and I will. This is David Yisraeli. Now, he wrote a paper for Bar-Ilan University. It's a religious university in Israel. It was called The Palestinian Problem and German Politics. Let me quote him. It was quite the paper and it was quite the research. It was the Haganah, the military arm of the Jewish agency, the de facto labor Zionist militia that obtained permission to negotiate directly with the SS. A Haganah agent, his name was Fivo Focus, we'll return to it, to that name, arrived in Berlin on February 26, 1937, and was assigned Adolf Eichmann as his negotiating partner. And as we're about to see, that was a much deeper and more disturbing story, that the Haganah, who went to war against, by the way, they went to war against the revisionists, what were they revising themselves against? They were revising themselves against labor Zionism. They were the Irgun. The Haganah, working with the British, arrested them. If they weren't executed, they were sent to East Africa and British prisoner of war camps. The Haganah went to war against what people would say is Netanyahu's party. It's not true. It was Begin's party. Begin was the head of the Irgun. It was his party. He was on the lam for years from the Haganah. The Haganah were negotiating with Adolf Eichmann. We will return to that. But let's go back to David Yisraeli's paper on the era of the 30s and 40s in Germany. Now, what he did, he met at, Yad Vashem is Jerusalem's Holocaust Museum. Know it. Very depressing, horrible place, filled with guilt, and I never realized how much guilt. In 1983, this is Yisraeli writing, I met Yoav Gelber, a scholar at Jerusalem's Yad Vashem Holocaust Center. I asked what he knew of Polkas. Quote, the Haganah Archives refuses to let me see his file. And then a Yisraeli asked him, why the heck not? And Yoav Gelber answered, there is no file because it would be too embarrassing. The above-mentioned Jew, Fivel Polkas, was an active figure in the Jewish intelligence service, the Haganah, or what you would call the IDF today. He was known because he visited Berlin between February 26th and March 2nd, 1937. And his whole visit was, it became a file written by a Nazi named Dr. Reichert, if you have to know. But most important, all right, Polkas, this is the German writing, is well acquainted with all important matters occurring in the Jewish world. A plan, quote, in coordination with the Gestapo, was formulated to enlist Polkas as a steady source of information for the SS. He stated that he is ready to serve Germany and supply information to the Gestapo. This is a representative from the Haganah in Berlin. He said, and he gives a whole bunch of things that he was willing to do in exchange for monetary regulations being loosened for Germans who wish to emigrate to Palestine. That's called a transfer agreement. We'll get to it.
And I think it's so vitally important to understand that the common denominator behind all of this negotiation with the Nazis was to get forced Jews, or at least some Jews, to go to Palestine. They wanted to establish this country there, and they knew it, and thus things got terribly, terribly bad in Germany. The average Jew would never want to give up his comfortable life there, his profession, and go off and live in an agrarian society. And so there was a small group of Jews who were working closely with the Nazis to make sure that there would be atrocities against the Jews, and then the remaining Jews would, about maybe 2 million of them, would be willing to go off to Palestine. Of course, they didn't get that many, but go right ahead, Barry.
They didn't. Well, that's the Weizmann quote. We'll get to it, all right. That's Chaim Weizmann, head of the Jewish Agency, way back in 1935, saying the Holocaust is coming. He used the word Holocaust, Shoah, and he said maybe 2 million will survive it, but they'll be the strongest and the best for the new land of Eretz Israel or Palestine. Very, very depressing. They knew the Holocaust was coming. They were if they weren't planning it with the Nazis let them know, and they said, okay, if you go ahead and do it, we won't put up any economic barriers, any boycotts, nothing will be done to in any way harm the Nazi regime. That was part of the secret deal of the transfer agreement. Oh, gosh almighty. All right, let's go back to the work of Dr. Reichardt. We are now talking about Pavlov in Germany, and all right, here's the quote right here. Polkus in Germany. For the work of contacting Polkus, we especially suggest SS group leader Adolf Eichmann of Department 11/112, who was in charge of the previous discussion with Polkus in Berlin, and was invited by the latter to visit the Jewish colonies in Palestine as his guest. Yes, Eichmann visited Palestine and had a grand old time with Fivel Polkus, his guide, the head of this division of the Haganah, the division that negotiated with the Nazis. Now I'm going to read again from Dr. Reichardt. Polkus can be given the following assurances. One, pressure can be put on the Reich representation of the Jews in Germany in such a way that those Jews emigrating from Germany will go exclusively to Palestine and nowhere else. This is, all right, needless to say, if you didn't go to Palestine, you wanted, and by the way, only less than 1% of Jews were Zionists before 1933. They didn't want to go to Palestine, and they didn't go, but they had to, because the Nazis were funneling them there.
Yes, those that didn't want to, of course, an awful lot of them died because they didn't want to leave Germany. But basically what people don't understand is there were Jews who were actively working with the Nazis, actually going right along with the terrible atrocities that took place, because their dream was a Jewish Palestine, an Israel. They wanted to form Israel. It was a wonderful dream, but of course it came at a terrible, terrible price. And in fact, you've never heard of this shows how totally controlled is of what the American people think and believe.
Let us swear allegiance.
right ahead.
Yeah, I'm still reading from Dr. Reichardt, who was assigned Fivel Polkus' trip to Germany. Oh, gosh, it hurts. All right, let's see what was promised of Polkus by the Nazis. Well, the last was that Eichmann would be his, his partner in this, and would go visit Palestine, and he does. Lest you think that Eichmann was just an anti-Semite, no, he likes certain Jews who just simply wanted the other Jews removed. They wanted an Israel formed under a terribly, terribly anti-religious banner. Now, I'm not going to dive into the whole story of what this banner was, but it begins with a false messiah of the 17th century named Shabtai Tzvi. And it's a long story worthy of a whole show to describe it. But the fact is, the Jews who are working with Eichmann, in other words, the Haganah, they didn't want religious Jews populating their new Israel. They wanted German Jews as seed stock, and they would take whoever survived the upcoming Holocaust, well, basically as their soldiers. They'll be nice and compliant after the Holocaust, they figured. Let's go to Dr. Reichardt. At the same time, Polkus' plans to create a Jewish majority in Palestine would be aided through this measure, too. Those Jews arrested under suspicion of working for the Haganah would be freed. Now, I want to stress this. The Haganah existed only in Palestine. That's it. If they could be free from arrest, the only people who could free them were the British. That's it. The British knew about this transfer agreement. And the British started arresting the enemies of the Haganah in Israel, the revisionists. While the Holocaust was destroying every Jew, torturing and murdering every Jew, the Nazis are captured in Europe, 6 million of them, with only 100,000, probably less, surviving. The Haganah were working with the British to arrest the Jews, those remaining Zionists, who really wanted nothing to do with them. And this is part of the history I may dive into a little later. The British had to have been part of this.
They certainly were, and hold on, because the reason they were is because there were many people very much involved with the occult. We'll be right back. This is Dr. Stan, I guess it's Barry Samage, and he is, of course, going into the background of what happened. Suddenly the small contingent of Jews that worked with the Nazis to create the Holocaust so that they could create the state of Palestine. That's what it was all about. Of course, the British, the people who control the British government, were working certainly behind the scenes with the Nazis for exactly the same purpose. You're never going to hear these things, but Barry's a researcher, and he's been able to ferret all of this out. But at a tremendous expense, because, of course, as a loyal citizen of Israel, he gave the majority of his life to his preservation of that society, only to find out that it was formed by people who had an intense hatred of Judaism. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, these are the Israeli labor. This is, you know, the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, was one of these dastardly figures in the 40s, working with the Nazis. Oh, Look, Paris ran literally, he was literally the Vatican assassin to the new state of Israel. But I won't dive into that. But labor Zionism, that's the Zionism of Shimon Peres. It was the Zionism of Yitzhak Rabin. It brought us peace with the PLO. It brought us really the destruction of Israel, the removal of Israel from the Sinai, the removal from the northern, from northern Judea, the northern Samaria, I'm sorry. In short, 80% of Israeli land that gave the country breathing space, well, it's gone. Same guys who were working with the Nazis arranged that. But let's go back to Dr. Reichardt and what he wrote. He was so delighted with Polkus that he, quote, money would be made available to Polkus for his services to the Gestapo. God Almighty. I continue. After talking with Assessor Wilmans of the Reich Economic Ministry, who is an expert on Palestinian transfer affairs, we'll get to that. In short, an arrangement was made that transferring the money of German Jews through the transfer agreement to Palestine would not have further costs to the Gestapo Security Service. Well, Polkus must have offered a great deal. It won't cost you anything. Make sure when they get to Palestine, the money in their banks in Germany get to them, and they have to buy German goods in Palestine, or they don't get their money. That was the transfer agreement. The Jews would put in their Reich marks, and it would be held in escrow until they got to Palestine, when it would be released with German exports. I don't know if I've described it, but that is the transfer agreement. And then let's go on to the background of how this reality, and it was reality. Here's where it went. On October 2nd, 1937, the liner Romania arrived in Haifa with two journalists aboard, Herbert Hagen and his junior colleague Adolf Eichmann. They met Fivel Polkus, who showed them Haifa from Mount Carmel and took them to visit a kibbutz. And by the way, we'll get to Eichmann. He had a grand old time. He had a great time on the kibbutz. Who knows how they made it a great time, but he left with a tremendous impression of labor Zionism. Now, let's look. This is from the Labor Zionist magazine in 1942, March. It's called The Jewish Frontier. Take this seriously. This is what happened to Jews. The fashion for Zionist speakers, including this writer. Whoops, I'll wait for the
music. No, go right ahead. I'll tell you when to stop. Go ahead.
Is to declare from the platform that, quote, to be a good Zionist, one must first be an anti-Semite. Oh, gosh. One can sense this attitude. Now, I'm going to give you a list of the founders of Eretz Yisrael, the writers that provided the intellectual foundation for Eretz Yisrael are coming up now. Just know that. Every city's got a Pinsker Street. Well, one can sense this in the attitude of Pinsker's writing. One can sense it in the writings of Serkin and Paul.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. right ahead, Barry.
Right, you go. Very, very upsetting, very upsetting. I'll continue with this quote about how much they owe to this new anti-Semitism amongst the Jews. The two main theoreticians of the labor Zionist movement, A.D. Gordon, he wrote, heck, the author of the idea of the religion of labor, Dat HaAvuda, wrote in a spirit of extreme contrition about the national sins of the Jews, which must be atoned by manual labor. And then the next writer, intellectual founder of Eretz Yisrael, I.H. Brenner, he is described as the Dostoevsky in Hebrew literature, indulged in masochistic self-flagellation. To this day, labor Zionist circles are under the influence of the idea that the return to Zion involves a process of purification from our economic uncleanliness. Whosoever does not engage in so-called productive manual labor is believed to be a sinner against Israel and against mankind. This is what founded Israel.
Doesn't make any sense, but that's all right. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, it makes sense if you want to turn your people into farmers that can turn this half desert called Palestine into a viable state. You got to get them to stop being professionals and take to the hole. Look, I have relatives in Israel, distant, and I've found them and traced down family ties, and it doesn't matter. They didn't come, their fathers didn't come to Israel in the case of Yaakov.
Hold the thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is just talking about something. He has relatives. Basically, his dad, I think, came of a family of 10 or 12.
No, my grandfather.
Grandfather, and basically, what was it? 8 of the 10?
It was 12, and 10 of the 12 were murdered.
Well, anyway, Barry traced down some of his other relatives. I mean, 10 of the 12 were murdered, but there were a few relatives. And basically, you're commenting on what you got from your remaining relatives when you checked and talked to them. What did they tell you?
They didn't know that. They thought it was a blessing they came to Israel, and it was great that they escaped. And they went through labor Zionist camps. They thought it was just terrific, a way to escape the Holocaust. They didn't know. All right? They became from professionals to farmers. And like I say, Israel was really a God-forsaken place. Before it became a country in the kibbutzim and the moshavim, and they started to actually make things grow there, it was really a very ugly place. Well, that's what the policy was. You get these Jews to become farmers. And that's what they did. They put them in camps in Germany and Austria, labor Zionist camps. They trained them in this crap that Jews are the banksters of the world, and you got to be purified, and the only way to do that is to engage in manual labor. This is actually happening. 2,000 years of culture in Europe came rushing to the end. Either you died or you went to Israel, and lucky old you get to farm the land. Now, again, from the point of view of you're trying to be a majority in a country that really can't support very many people, well, you start off as farmers, I suppose. But the fact of the matter is, when everyone else dies, it's no great honor to be on a kibbutz when in Germany everyone is dying. They got, of the German Jews, maybe 70,000 out. They were the seed stock of modern Israel. The rest died. Anyone who tried to escape, they were turned back. It was a complete worldwide conspiracy against the Jews. And as I say, the British ran Palestine. The transfer agreement went through them. All right. And the Haganah arresting the revisionists, that is to say, Menachem Begin's Chayrut, the British sent them to their camps. No matter that the Nazis did the killing, no matter that they were cruel beyond belief, no matter that Germans are tarred forever and ever and ever, that they were the nation capable of this kind of cruelty, the British behind the scenes had their thumbs in this deal as well. That's all. That was the point.
Okay, go right ahead. I think it's a point very important for people to understand. And, of course, the reason for this, at least in my estimation, is there are strong occult beliefs that the leaders among Great Britain, as there are strong occult forces working within the Nazi movement, and nobody ever talks about that. In fact, Hitler himself came from deeply from the occult, but we never talk about that. We talk about his personality, what he did, but not why he did it. Go right ahead, Barry.
That's too deep for me right now. I'm just doing the raw stuff. Look, in 1934, the Nazis sent a rep to Palestine for 6 months as a guest of the WZO, the World Zionist Organization. He was the guest of the WZO, and when he returned, the Nazi newspaper wrote it was called Dürr and Grief. It was the Nazis' chief party organization. He wrote a 12-part series on his adventures in Palestine. Now, to commemorate this little expedition, the propaganda minister, Goebbels, had a medal struck. On one side was the swastika, on the other, the Star of David. Bet you didn't know that.
Not until you told me. Go ahead.
Well, this, by the way, comes directly from the German, the Nazi newspaper, Dürr and Grief, the attack that we have got a medal, one with the swastika, which is on every medal, but on the other side, the Star of David. Oh, gosh. Now, I'm going to finish off this segment. All right, and then I'll go back to the horrible story from the beginning. George Koreski. Now, after he realized he'd been fooled, he joined the revisionist, that is, Begin's anti-labor Zionist movement. Oh, gosh, almighty, this hypocrite. Nonetheless, well, let's put it this way. Koreski, after Hitler came to power, saw them as the only equivalent of Zionists, the successful Nazis. He saw a lot in common with them. And the Nazis allowed only the state Zionists, that is the labor Zionists, the right to wear uniforms indoors. Apparently in Germany, no Jew could wear a uniform indoors. Well, no Jew but the labor Zionists. There was a complete, remember, the transfer agreement was signed September 1933. From that point on, there was a really, really close alliance between these damn labor Zionists. And there is no excusing this, by the way. This is actually what happened. They sold out their people. They sold them out. There was a direct alliance between them and the Nazis. Oh, gosh, this hurts. It hurts the more you think about it. It really does. The fact is that it's the same today, and there's nothing much I can do about it. The religious, they should know all about this collaboration, and they should know that these same labor Zionists are doing everything in their power to remove them from their homes. But they're wearing blinders. They look at it and say, oh, this is a political deal. Oh, this is the Americans trying to wrongly bring peace. They look at it from every point of view, but the real point of view that these labor Zionists don't care if they live or die. And if they have to die, they will watch them die. Again. All right, away we go. Away we go. Look, and by the way, when I tell this story of the Zionist collaboration with the Nazis, it's not for anything anti-Israel. It's to save my people, to make sure there isn't another Holocaust coming up with the same gang on top of it. But I'm failing. And the Jews won't... I don't know. Where do these blinders come from? But they somehow are blinding religious Jews of the danger facing them. And you would think after they got thrown out of Gaza, they'd realize they have no protection in Israeli society. None. Zero. So they went homeless, paying mortgages for homes that were bulldozed. Nothing has changed. Nothing. And you've got one itty-bitty little piece of territory left, and that is what's called the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Once they're gone from there, who knows how long Israel will survive, but watch out. About 350,000 Jewish so-called settlers are about to be, how do we put this, removed forcibly from their homes of 38, 40 years. It's coming up. Now, I quoted someone named Lenny Brenner. I've known about him for a long time, but his motive for writing about the transfer agreement was very iffy. It was very, very anti-Jewish. Nonetheless, his basic facts aren't wrong. And I've got lots more writers who are very, very proud Jews who are trying to put a stop to this murderous lie. Well, he's not one of them. But his facts aren't wrong necessarily, but his conclusions are. And they lead to all kinds of deceptive reasoning. Now, I'm going to take one example. There was a murder of the negotiator of the transfer agreement. His name was Chaim Arlozorov. He was murdered in Tel Aviv in 1933. And the opposition to labor Zionism, the Herut, were blamed for it long enough to have them thrown out of the Jewish agency. Now, I'm going to give my writing right now so you understand how labor Zionism became the only authority in Israel representing all the Jews of the world. My writing now. In 1932, there were three branches of Zionism, Labor, Herut, and the Orthodox. In the same year, over 250 organizations represented the Jews of Germany. That same year, Labor presented a deal to the Nazis that would see the Herut and Orthodox removed from the Zionist shadow government of Israel and reduce the number of organizations representing German Jewry to one, Labor Zionism. The deal became the transfer agreement. The labor Zionists promised the Nazis to end worldwide sanctions and boycotts against their regime in return for making life impossible for German Jews, forcing them to emigrate to Palestine. Heyrut got wind of this atrociously immoral agreement and fought it tooth and nail to nip the revolt in the bud. The labor chief negotiator of the agreement, Chaim Arlozorov, was murdered in Tel Aviv, and Heyrut was blamed just for long enough to provide an excuse to remove them from power. That's how the game was really played. Where Brenner is coming from is it's a twisted misreading. In short, the bad guys in this story are the labor Zionists and the guys who try to put an end to this transfer agreement, give the Jews guns to let them fight back. They were, according to Brenner, the bad guys. I have problems with this. Nonetheless, it's not as if I'm alone. Thank goodness I'm not alone. We have all kinds of people who can't stand this anymore. Edwin Black wrote the transfer agreement, 850 pages of this horrible, horrible, horrible pact. But he's not the only one. My good friend for many, many years, over two decades, Rabbi Marvin Antleman, he wrote to eliminate the opiate. The opiate, of course, is religion, and it was the murder of the religious Jews by the labor Zionists. And, well, the great book by Ben Heck, who was a Hollywood writer, he wrote... Well, let's not get into him. He was good. He was a funny Hollywood writer. He wrote Perfidy with more awful details about the pact between Adolf Eichmann and Rudolf Kastner that eventually saw Kastner murdered in his hospital room in Tel Aviv in 1954. He was hushed up that way. And Adolf Eichmann becoming the only Nazi ever convicted in an Israeli court. He was in a soundproof booth. He could be screaming whatever he wants. No one ever heard it. The only Nazi murdered by Israel. And there were many, many who deserved to be put in an Israeli courtroom and properly given justice. Well, they didn't get out. They mostly went through, they were Dominican and Jesuit and Benedictine monasteries, mostly in Italy, given phony papers and sent off about 100,000 of them, mostly to South America, but also plenty to America itself and also plenty to Australia. The Vatican saved Nazism, and Israel let them do it. Why they captured Eichmann? Well, the business with Kastner was becoming big. There was a trial in Israel. A journalist named Malkiel Greenwald was sued for saying that Kastner worked with Eichmann to murder Jews, and he won the case. Now, I'm going to now quote you.
Now, wait a minute. Would you repeat that? I think that's a very important statement. Basically, this fellow had a case. He was sued because he said that Eichmann had killed Kastner. The fellow won the case.
No.
Oh, go ahead. Okay.
No.
What is it? Go ahead.
Kastner was killed by the labor Zionists.
Okay, fine then. What was the lawsuit about?
Kastner went to Hungary and negotiated with Adolf Eichmann, supposedly to save the Jews. Eichmann had about 500,000 of them. He could have got them out. Kastner didn't want them out. Eichmann cut a deal where he saved maybe 3,000 friends and families of labor Zionism and exterminated another 500,000.
Okay, that's, but basically then, what was the lawsuit about? What did this fellow say?
That he was not selling Jews down the drain, that Greenwald was wrong. Well, Greenwald won the suit, and the game was up for Kastner. He was hushed up in Israel, and the game was up for Eichmann. He had to be hushed up. He was kidnapped to Israel.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up the program with...
Wrap up? Really?
While the storm clouds gather...
Barry, you go right ahead.
How much time do we have?
Well, we got another 4 or 5 minutes.
Oh, my goodness gracious. All right. First of all, I'm going to plug me very, very quickly. Thanks to your show, I have someone named David who is working on my website. That was through you. He heard my appeal to you, just so you know. Look, the website is BarryChamish.com. Get my books. If the website is working, you'll know they're at Lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. Write in Chamish, C-H-A-M-I-S-H, BarryChamish.com, and go to the books on this subject. The best is probably Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism, and the Holocaust. Well, I'm just going to finish off just by quoting Eichmann from Life magazine. Eichmann was in 1955, Eichmann, hiding in Argentina, discussed Kastner on tape. After his capture in 1960, Life magazine published excerpts. Now, he went to a kibbutz, I told you. Paul was taken to a kibbutz. Here was his impression. He did see enough to be very impressed by the way the Jewish colonists were building up their land. I admired their desperate will to live, the more so since I myself was an idealist. In the years that followed, I often said to Jews with whom I had dealings that had I been a Jew, I would have been a fanatical Zionist. I could not imagine being anything else. In fact, I would have been the most ardent Zionist imaginable. That was from Life magazine, 28th November 1960.
And that was Adolf Eichmann, right?
It sure was. Here's the next week. On December 5th, 1960, he described Kastner as a fanatical Zionist. He agreed to help the Jews from resisting deportation and even keep order in the collection camps if I would close my eyes and let a few hundred or a few thousand young Jews emigrate illegally to Palestine. Again, without British help, couldn't have been done. It was a good bargain. For keeping order in the camps, the price of 15,000 or 20,000 Jews, in the end there may have been more, was not too high for me.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. Barry is simply quoting some articles that appeared, I think, in Life magazine, where he actually admitted, certainly, working with Kastner and working, certainly, making a deal with him to let a few Jews go in return for Kastner's help in maintaining order and getting the Jews to go along with the Nazi program. Rather than resist their eventual destruction, Kastner went along and got the Jews to cooperate with the Nazis, the worst thing he could have done because he knew he was signing the death warrant. Barry, we're out of time. Why don't you wrap up the program for us?
And because Kastner rendered us a great service by helping keep the deportation camps peaceful, I would let his groups escape to Palestine. There's where Israel came from. Folks, it's all I've got to say, and it's breaking my heart, and I can't stand this anymore. But this is objective truth, and it's really a story you were not told, and you have got to start believing. Israel was a complete insult to the Jews, a total insult. But we're there, and we have to to somehow or another make it survive.
God bless, Barry. Thank you very much. Appreciate everything you do. Look forward to talking to you real soon.
I do as well.
Bye-bye.
Night all.
Okay, fine. Well, that's the Barry Sammons. And basically, we do hope many of you want to get listen to Barry's program, certainly on this subject, and certainly the betrayal of the Jewish race by the labor Zionists. Now, all we do have, if you wanted to get several CDs, you can call in and order them. But we do have a four-tape set or a four-CD set by Barry. It's called The Return of the Giants on an entirely different subject. It is the supernatural of visits to Israel over a period of about 10 years by supernatural beings. And basically, they appeared somewhere in the mid-1980s. They were there until the mid-1990s and certainly plaguing people. A fascinating insight into the supernatural forces at work within Israel. It's called The Return of the Giants. And you can get the 4-CD set by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Of course, we have other sources on that, along that line. If you haven't heard, certainly our 4-CD set on the supernatural, or the 4-CD set on the Aquarian Conspiracy, a series of interviews with Constance Cumby, you get them by calling 1-800-544-8927. Then how do you tie this all together? Well, you get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. And you get them by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And basically, of course, you can go then to our website of RadioLiberty.com. You can certainly watch our DVDs free of charge. You can listen to our radio programs. We do, as you know, 5 hours of talk radio a day, 5 days a week, and you can listen to 4 hours of that, 5 hours live at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can read our newsletters. You can go to certainly our website and read about population control, the population control agenda, the Georgia Guidestones, this occult monument put up by a secret society. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are secret societies. I've been there many times. In fact, we've written some of the fundamental work about the Georgia Guidestones and investigated it. But you can get information at our website, RadioLiberty.com, on the Georgia Guidestones. And then we have a new section on the top of our webpage. It's called News Around the Net. News Around the Net, and you can go there and just click on that, and then there's all sorts of articles. You can pull them up, you can watch them, put them on your website, get other people to watch. Understand we're involved in a spiritual battle. There really are supernatural forces out there, and we hope you'll join us in this epic struggle for the survival of Christian civilization and the souls of men. So please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection, if you can join the Radio Liberty family, please do.